This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And there's a lot of tension about whether this process will continue as planned because the ceasefire has to hold on both sides.
That was journalist Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv talking about the mood as the agreement for a ceasefire and hostage release between Israel and Hamas goes into effect. Details coming up. Also, a tree planting program is easing conflicts around a refugee camp in Cameroon. And the government in Ivory Coast says former Prime Minister Guillaume Soro can come home. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A four-day ceasefire in the Israeli-Hamas war began today in Gaza as part of an agreement that Qatar helped broker. Qatar officials say 24 hostages held in Gaza were freed, 13 Israeli citizens, 10 Thai citizens, and one Philippine citizen. They were being handed over to Israeli military officials and taken to hospitals for checkups. With the truce deal comes increased shipments of fuel and supplies into Gaza, though aid groups say if the amount is still only enough to dent the needs of the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza who have endured weeks of Israeli bombardment. Israel has agreed to allow the delivery of 130,000 liters of fuel a day into besieged Gaza for humanitarian needs during the truce. Hamas fighters and other militants took about 240 Israelis and foreign nationals hostage when they attacked Israel communities on October 7th. The militants killed about 1,200 Israelis and foreigners, most of them civilians. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed in the Israeli bombardment and ground offensive. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he will press ahead with the war after the ceasefire expires. Earlier today, I spoke with journalist Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv about the hostage transfer. So, Ricky, Israel and Hamas have been negotiating for weeks over the hostages. A deal had seemed to have been working within reach. But on a few occasions, only it never materialized. But now things are moving. We are seeing some movement. So talk to us right now. What is the latest on the exchange of hostages and prisoners?
Well, the process started at 7 a.m. local time when the ceasefire went into effect in Gaza. And then during the course of the day, Hamas was supposed to be rounding up the Israeli hostages who were released from a hospital in Gaza at about 4:30 this afternoon, about an hour and a half ago. And then they were handed over to the Red Cross, who brought them through Gaza to the border of Egypt. And we're now waiting thousands of Israelis and especially the families of these 13 hostages are waiting to see who exactly is in the ambulances of the Red Cross.
Is it known when more hostages will be freed?
Well, the terms of the agreement were for a four-day ceasefire. Each day would be, there would be 12 to 13 Israeli hostages released, together with 39 Palestinian prisoners who are in Israeli jails for security offenses. They would also be released to the West Bank. Besides the ceasefire, there would be a huge amount of humanitarian aid, including fuel, let into Gaza from the border with Egypt.
So after 7 weeks of fighting, there is this agreement for a four-day ceasefire and the release of some hostages. Ricky, what is the mood there?
The mood is very mixed. there, I think, is a huge amount of relief that this process has begun, the process of getting the hostages back. There's also sadness because the vast majority of the hostages are still in captivity. And there's a lot of tension about whether this process will continue as planned because the ceasefire has to hold on both sides. And the list of the Israeli hostages who are supposed to be released tomorrow hasn't yet been released. So everybody, there's a state of high tension waiting to see that things will go as planned.
Journalist Riki Rosen on the line from Tel Aviv, briefing us on the latest. Thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Leaders of the U.S. advocacy group Americans for Peace say they are pleased there has been a ceasefire in Gaza and hope it could begin to shape a post-war reality that ends hostilities while providing security for Israel and addressing the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. Ori Nears is the spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, and he tells VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi there is hope for what comes after the conflict.
First of all, we see a process in which some of the goals that Israel has stated before it started the war are on the road of being achieved. So we are in a process of releasing hostages, which hopefully will continue to unfold until all hostages are released. We are seeing the very significant weakening of Hamas militarily, which is, again, one of the goals of this war. And we see a weakening of, I think also, we'll probably see a weakening of Hamas's political influence as a result of its losing its military capabilities. Already we see a reduction in Hamas violence and its ability to launch rockets into Israel. So there's no contradiction between what Netanyahu said and what we see on the ground. What I really hope, though, is that what we see on the ground at the moment, which is a process of gradually releasing hostages, gradually stabilizing the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, and gradually stabilizing the security situation on the Israeli side of the border, that all these will bring about a certain process that both will bring about the rebuilding and maybe even recreating of the Gaza Strip. And that's one thing. And then a recreation of Israeli-Palestinian relations, one that would be based on quest for peace rather than on recrimination and revenge and a cycle of violence.
President Biden asserts this road must lead to a new era in Israeli-Palestinian relations, one that's governed by pursuit of an agreement that would result in two sovereign states for the benefit of both peoples. How feasible is that given the continued settlement activities and some attempts to force Palestinians out?
Right. So, you know, this is a question that we've talked about in the past, and we always talk about the viability of a two-state solution. And it does seem, you know, this is a very bleak moment. It's a moment where people are still bleeding, figuratively and not figuratively as well, where people are focusing on the violence and the enmity and so on. But, you know, as we've seen in the past, moments of crisis often also provide a certain opportunity. And there could be an opportunity here for Israelis and Palestinians to really, you know, push the reset button and look at the reality of relations between them, not through the gun, but rather through an opportunity to establish peaceful relations. It is true that, you know, you talked about settlement activity and so on. We are seeing, you know, a beefing up of settlements since October 7th. There have been seven new small settlements, what's called illegal outposts built in the West Bank and new illegal roads that lead to them and so on. But on the other hand, there's also a situation in Israel where public opinion is coming out against the settlers and the settler movement. And there very well may be in the day after, when people look about what led to October 7th and look at the ideology of the members of this government, that there will be some kind of a backlash and a greater support of a peaceful resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict rather than constant pursuit of military might and and war. I know that at the moment it seems far and it seems unattainable, but I really do think that there is some source of hope. Realistically, there is a source for hope in that regard.
That was Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, a Washington organization advocating for a sustainable peace between Israelis and Palestinians through a two-state solution. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. As you just heard, the first hostages have been freed by Hamas in return for Israel releasing Palestinians it has imprisoned. Leonard Rubenstein, a human rights lawyer and professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health near Washington, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, it is a hopeful day for Palestinians, Israelis, and others around the world who want to see an end to hostilities in the Middle East.
We don't know what's going to happen next. It would certainly be wonderful if it were extended. There has been talk about possibly having negotiations for release of more hostages, extending this pause, and maintaining the supply of humanitarian aid. If that happens, it would save many more lives and benefit Palestinians and Israelis.
As you know, these aid trucks are getting in now, and more, way more than there was in the past. Is this going to make a serious dent in the suffering of the thousands of people, Palestinians, that are stuck in northern Gaza especially?
Well, it's certainly about time after all these weeks for more humanitarian aid to come in. Before the war, there were 500 trucks a day, and the most before now was like something like 100. And given the extent of the catastrophe from a humanitarian standpoint, it's essential that the increase in number of trucks coming in be maintained. It's going to take an enormous amount of work and an enormous number of supplies to restore, in any sense, the ability of Palestinians to live in Gaza.
Are you hopeful that fuel and the other emergency supplies are going to be getting through now in these next 4 days?
Well, part of the deal, as I understand it, is that fuel will be coming in. More fuel will be coming in.
And I suppose that fuel and things like that are going to be going directly to hospitals and facilities like that.
Yes, the idea is for the fuel to come in without control by Hamas. So that it won't go to Hamas-operated facilities. It will be monitored. There will be all kinds of checks and inspections and the like to make sure it's not used for military activities by Hamas.
That's Leonard Rubenstein, a human rights lawyer and professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from the U.S. state of Virginia. Ivory Coast's government says former Prime Minister Guillaume Soro, who recently ended a self-imposed exile in Europe and the Middle East, could return home, but that the justice system would rule on his outstanding convictions. Soro was sentenced to life in prison for undermining national security in 2021. He returned to Africa in early November after spending 4 years in exile in France, Belgium, and Dubai, but he has not yet returned to his homeland. The former prime minister fell out with President Alassane Ouattara in 2019, with the head of state accusing him of fomenting a civilian and military insurrection. He was handed a 20-year jail term in 2020 in absentia after being convicted of embezzlement, then given a life term a year later for undermining national security. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Officials in northern Cameroon say conflicts over food, water, and other resources have greatly declined due to the planting of about 500,000 trees in and around a refugee camp. UN officials and rights groups visited the area to collect success stories on reforestation projects that also reduce climate shocks to share during the upcoming COP28 climate conference. Moki Edwin Kendeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Residents and officials in northern Cameroon, near the border with Nigeria and Chad, say clashes between refugees, displaced persons and host communities over food and water have declined in the past year, mainly due to the new forest growing in their midst. The area is home to about 120,000 refugees from Nigeria, along with a number of internally displaced Cameroonians and returnees whose lives were uprooted by terrorist group Boko Haram. 10 years ago, UNHCR set up the Minawawo refugee camp on about 630 hectares of land near the borders to house 15,000 refugees. But unending violence swelled the camp's population to 72,000, exerting pressure on natural resources. A 26-year-old mother of two, Lietu Habila, fled Nigeria and came to the camp to escape Boko Haram violence in 2016. She says conflicts between local residents, refugees, and displaced persons over resources like food and firewood happened almost on a daily basis.
The time that
Habila says she is very happy now because she can cut tree branches and use them for cooking, unlike in the past when it was very difficult to find wood at the Minawawo refugee camp. She says besides cutting down a few tree branches to use as fuel wood, the refugee agency UNHCR has taught them how to make nurseries to plant more trees and make briquettes or compressed blocks of coal dust that help them in cooking. Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria is one of the most ecologically fragile areas in Central Africa. The Cameroon government says climate change, population growth, and rampant exploitation of wood and non-timber plant resources threatens ecological biodiversity and has plunged civilians into deep poverty. The United Nations reports that in 2016, five Nigerian refugee leaders got together and decided to plant trees in the Minawawo camp to alleviate the situation. Trees planted include cassia, neem, acacia, moringa, cashew, and luxenia, which are all drought-resistant and have branches that can be pruned and used for fuel. Some of their leaves are also used for medicine, food, or fertilizer. The UNHCR reports that close to 500,000 trees have been planted in and around the Minawawo camp. Refugees and host populations say the trees make it possible for them to create gardens in shade, feed and care for animals, and reduce conflicts related to sharing resources. Women say they are no longer exposed to sexual abuse and violence while trekking long distances to fetch firewood and carry water. UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador and environmental activist Mtital Mahmoud visited northern Cameroon this month. She says she listened to refugees' success stories and experiences about the impact of the reforestation project in their daily lives.
The stories that we're seeing in Cameroon are not just stories of crisis, but they're also stories of triumph, stories of resilience, stories of resourcefulness that people are doing to not only survive but thrive in the face of adversity, in the face of our changing climate. I do believe that these solutions created by refugees and led by refugees, seeing this work in Minawal tells me it can work in Darfur, Nepal, it can work in Bangladesh, because there are so many similar contexts.
Speaking to Cameroon state broadcaster CRTV, Mahmoud, who is also a former refugee, said she documented what she called powerful messages and insights to bring to the attention of the world during COP28. She said addressing climate change and supporting initiatives like the refugee reforestation project in Cameroon should be a priority on all development agendas. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Ghana's coastline is home to dozens of historic forts, castles, and other UNESCO World Heritage sites, which are threatened by coastal erosion and frequent tidal waves. Illegal sand mining is making the problem worse. A photographer whose ancestral home has been submerged about 3 kilometers into the ocean is using photo exhibitions to raise awareness about the situation. Sananu Tord reports from Ada, Ghana.
Along the coast of Ada in Ghana, photographer Ofwe Amagavi is taking photos of a ruined settlement. Occupants of this property were forced out after several tidal waves and coastal erosion demolished their homes and threatened their lives. Amagavi says his ancestral home was once about a 15-minute walk away, but has been completely submerged in the Gulf of Guinea. Born and raised in the capital city of Accra, Amagavi moved back in 2019 to connect with his ancestry and heritage, but he says there was nothing to show.
Then coming here, trying to trace some of the stories my dad told me, I now came to realize why most of his stories were coming from the past and not necessarily present continuous, but I was always referring to the past. It was due to the fact that his home wasn't existing anymore. Where he was born and raised wasn't existing anymore because of the effects of coastal erosion.
According to UNESCO, Ghana's coastline is eroding at an average rate of about 2 meters per year, with some sites recording up to 17 meters of erosion in a single year. Between 2005 and 2017 alone, the country lost about 37% of its coastal land to erosion and flooding. Coastal residents say the erosion rate has increased even further in the last 2 years. John Kusimi is a senior lecturer at the Department of Geography and Resource Management at the University of Ghana. He says rising sea levels and climate change are increasing the frequency of tidal waves along the Ghanaian coast. Kusimi says the situation is made worse by increased sand mining, mostly for construction needs.
We have a lot of human activities such as sand mining, dredging, and also the harvesting of vegetative cover, mangroves in particular, along the coastline. These activities tend to reduce the resilience of the beach or the coastline to erosion.
Sand mining along the beaches of Ghana is illegal and punishable by law. But Kusimi says the country's boom in tourism and real estate along waterfronts has created a new market for the practice.
Because of the presence of security within the major cities, they go a little bit far off away the peri-urban localities and mine and bring the sand into the cities to develop. So you see a lot of hotels, estate developers, and then resource centers that are developing along the beaches and the coastline, and most of them often mine beach material illegally to use in their building and construction.
Through a recent photo exhibition titled Between Sand and Water and an upcoming exhibit in northern Ghana, Amagavi hopes to draw more attention to the ailing state of coastal communities and its effect on coastal biodiversity. Sena Anutod for VOA News, Ada, Ghana.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.